Hey, everybody, this is your big buddy, Gene Hoagland, and you are listening to The Vinyl Guide with my friend, Nate Goyer. Enjoy.
Oh, yeah, let's get it started. Hey, everyone, it's Nate, host of The Vinyl Guide. Thanks for tuning in this week. We are welcoming the Atomic Clock himself, Gene Hoagland of Dark Angel, one of the greatest metal drummers ever to walk the earth, the man behind the drum kits for Testament, Strapping Young Lad, Death, Fear Factory, and heaps more. Gene is touring now with Dark Angel, soon to be hitting the Australian shores. Tickets available at hardlinemedia.net. Gene is one of the best drummers on the planet and a real nice guy to speak with, and he even kept the interview going after this happened.
Oh, man, I just got stung by a bee. Jesus.
You did?
I have not been stung by a bee.
You're not allergic, are you?
No, we're about to find out.
All right. That's right. It's a very rare occasion when you hear one of the best drummers on earth getting stung by a bee. But we kept rolling. This is a great conversation. I'm sure you'll enjoy it. Oh, and by the way, I have a request out there. I need to get a copy of the new Tool Fear Inoculum Deluxe CD package. I did not want to buy from Amazon, and all the local shops oversold their supply, so I've been unfortunately left short. If you have an extra or know where to get one, email me at nate@thevinylguide.com. I'll happily pay for it, and I'll definitely give you a shout out, and mate, I will totally owe you one. And if you love drummers and heavy metal, you'll love some of the other episodes we have here on The Vinyl Guide, including episode 99 of The Vinyl Guide, featuring our interview with Charlie Benante of Anthrax, discussing all sorts of early thrash stories, record pressings, hanging with Cliff Burton, and more. That's episode 99 of The Vinyl Guide. Episodes 135 and 136 of The Vinyl Guide with Forbidden guitarist Craig LeCicero, talking us through his career from Forbidden to Man-Made God up to current day with Dress the Dead. That's episodes 135 and 136. And one for the drummers, Mike Portnoy of Sons of Apollo, Dream Theater, and more. Episode 116 of The Vinyl Guide. Get them all and more at thevinylguide.com or through our free digital apps at the Apple and Android app stores. Go get them now. And whether you're dusting off a copy of Dark Angel's Darkness Descends or Death's Individual Thought Patterns, you're going to want to clean your records right with the Groove Washer Record Cleaning Kit. Now, I don't know about you, but I don't have thousands of dollars to spend on one of those vacuum record cleaning machines. So, if you're like me, grab the Groove Washer as it's the best manual record cleaner you can buy. Your record store may have it, but if not, do not accept a cheap substitute. Head over to groovewasher.com and get the best manual record cleaner on the market, plus 10% off everything at groovewasher.com with discount code VINYLGUIDE10. Enter that at checkout. That's groovewasher.com, 10% off everything with checkout code VINYLGUIDE10. Oh, and by the way, huge thanks to Mike DeGrazio, David Phillips, and Dan for becoming patrons of the Vinyl Guide podcast at patreon.com/vinylguide. Heading up there and helping us with a couple of bucks each month not only keeps this podcast going, but also gives you exclusive access to content that you won't see anywhere else. We do secret episodes, we do pre-release episodes, pictures, more vinyl record information up there. Join our Patreon community at patreon.com/vinylguide. You may become as cool as Mike, David, or Dan, but we're not making any promises. Head over to patreon.com/vinylguide, and your patronage is much appreciated. And with that, everyone warm up your eardrums, because we are talking with the Atomic Clock, Gene Hoagland. This week on The Vinyl Guide, we are in rarefied air. It is drummer of Dark Angel, a man who has served valiantly behind the kits for Death, Testament, Strapping Young Lad, Forbidden, heaps more. The Atomic Clock, Mr. Gene Hoagland, is here on The Vinyl Guide. Gene, how are you today?
I'm doing great, Nate. How about yourself? All is well over here.
Excellent, excellent. Hey, question for you. Who first gave you the name The Atomic Clock?
You know, I think that was, I think it was Val the Heathen from Zimmer's Hole, the vocalist, because I remember we were we were rehearsing. He had a motorcycle shop that Strapping used to rehearse at, and I'd go down there and be jamming. And I think he just mentioned one time after we were jamming, like, "God damn, Gene, you're the atomic clock, man. You're just solid." And everybody heard that, and we all giggled about it. So it just kind of started sticking, you know. So that's kind of fun, you know. Beats Mean Gene the Drumming Machine or something, you know? cooler nickname, I suppose. But hey, I'll take it.
Are you also on time for things? Like, are you the atomic clock when you're not behind the drum kit?
You know what's funny is, yes, you know, it's like, God, I remember one time my wife and I were traveling. This is before we were together. We were traveling to I was going to go do a gig up in the Bay Area, and we were about, you know, 4.5 hours out. And I remember telling her, like, yeah, I think we're going to be pulling up right at 12:07 AM. And sure enough, we pulled up right at 12:07. You know, I'd made the trip a few times, and I just, you know, generally just, I know we're about 4.5 hours out, but I'll throw out a number. Sure enough, we pull up to the driveway at 12:07 AM. She was just like, "Holy moly, God, that's nuts." And so I'm pretty good with, if somebody asks, "Hey man, what time it is?" What time is it? And I'm usually pretty good with, like, nailing it. You know, it's 4:13, you know, "Hey, no shit, it's 4:13. Jesus." So that's pretty fun.
All right. So everyone who's listening, next time you see Gene, quiz him on this. Okay.
Ask him what time it is.
He will definitely know. All right. So Gene, we're looking forward to having you in Australia with Dark Angel here in September. Now, Australia seems to be a great market for metal these days. And you've been in metal long enough to where you've probably seen the rise of it in terms of the viability of being able to come here and play and actually make it worth it. Would you share that same view with Australia?
Absolutely. 100%. Totally. You know, that's one thing that Australia has always been really amazing for, is that Australia really took to the extreme side of metal, you know, way more so than, say, like, you know, a Germany or Switzerland sort of thing. You know, they love it brutal in Australia. And, you know, that's one thing, like, when I first started coming to Australia, I probably played there around 15 times or so over the years. And, you know, we started going over there with Strapping Young Lad back in 1997. And then again in 98, again in 99, 2000, 2001, we just kept going back there. And I think the fans were really appreciative of it, because, you know, they were like, "Hey, yeah, we understand, you know, bands make it down 1 year and then 6 or 7 years later, they come back, or maybe 8 years or maybe never. But damn, Strapping, you guys are making this a pretty, you know, regular tour stop for yourselves, and we appreciate that." So, you know, that was always really cool that, you know, we were able to keep going back there. The market was so strong. And like I say, Australia is super duper into the extreme side of metal. So that's always really helpful when you're in an extreme band. So, you know, it's a challenge to get there. Absolutely. And the touring itself is pretty challenging. You know, you never get many days off down there. You've usually got a bunch of shows butted up against each other, and, you know, I can walk you through it. Oh, absolutely. You know, late nights at the club, you know, by the time you get back to the hotel, you've got, okay, I got like 3 hours to go to sleep, and you got the, you know, super early alarm for the super early lobby call for the super early check-in for the next flight, and you land and you usually go straight to the venue sort of thing. You might be able to slide off to the hotel for a couple hours and catch a little nap, but you know, it is a grind, but it's worth it, you know, because you just want to make people happy. Hey, we're all entertainers. We want to have people have big smiles on their faces at the end of the night. So, you know, that's where Australians like to smile. They like to laugh. So we dig that.
And we like to drink down there. We like to drink.
Yeah, so indeed, absolutely, you know.
So I grew up in the Bay Area, and I was used to having bands play there sometimes 2 to 3 times a year. I mean, like regularly, you could count on Iron Maiden coming into town once a year, and it would be with their full show and everything. And when I moved to Australia, I discovered that Maiden had probably been there twice in their career, and it was quite often with half the stage show. Like, they didn't have the Big Eddie or anything like that. And there's such a difference of touring Australia. And I think people in the U.S., they may not understand the scale of it. A 4 or 5 date Australian tour is like going from San Francisco to Houston to New York to Chicago. I mean, these are not places you can take a bus to.
Absolutely. You know, Strapping's first tour was in a bus. You know, that's one thing that you guys don't have coaches down there. You don't have tour buses down there. So it's flights. But our opening band was a band called Alchemist, probably very well known in Australia. And they had the touring vehicle, you know, an old school bus where, you know, wasn't super comfortable, but we got to see Australia, you know, driving through the, you know, the outback or wherever, you know, seeing all sorts of, you know, the local critters, local creatures. You know, you got kangaroos in front of the van, in front of the bus, just, you know, hopping along and all that sort of thing. So it was a very unique viewpoint, and, you know, one that I have yet to have since 97. So, you know, cause now it's just get up early, get on the plane and go to the next place. But, you know, that's a grind. And yeah, the scope of touring down there, you know, the flights are challenging, and the day to day is challenging, but like I say, it's totally worth it, cause the Australian fans are all super awesome, and it's always cool to hang out with everybody, and everybody's got a really cool take on everything. And, you know the vibe. You move there, it's mm-hmm. it's pretty darn chill.
One of the best decisions I ever made in my life.
Excellent.
I think I saw you with Strapping in Sydney around 2002. And
okay.
I remember when you came out on stage, and this is my introduction to Strapping. I was with Doug Steele. I don't know if you know him from Alarum, but he took me to the show, and he pointed out, he's like, you see that big guy in the middle, that drummer? He's ambidextrous. And I watched you kind of go back and forth with your hands, and that, to me, that blew my mind. I'd never seen an ambidextrous drummer. How many of those are there?
Well, you know, I think there's a lot more ambidextrous people. I think everybody's ambidextrous to a degree. You know, there's probably some things you might do with your other hand that you don't even think about. You know, that's the way I feel.
Well, we won't
about
talk
it.
About those here, you know, but I mean, really, when you come to the drum kit,
yeah, totally.
Like how many?
What's that called? The strangers.
Like, are there any other ambidextrous drummers you know of?
I would imagine. You know, like that's one thing. You know, I would imagine like somebody like Dennis Chambers, you know, like I say, I think a lot of drummers are more ambidextrous than they give themselves credit for. And the whole reason, you know, I've always been ambidextrous. You know, I am mainly a right-handed, you know, I tend to write right-handed, throw right-handed, but I eat left-handed. I play drums open-handed. And, you know, I shave left-handed, you know, but I think there's a lot of ambidexterity in a lot of people that they're just probably not very cognizant of. So, but it sure has helped. Like there are a lot of times when, like, say for instance, like if you're in, like, say an opening band on a multi-band package, and say you're the opening band and you're sharing the kit with the second band, whether it's your kit or their kit, a lot of times there's not a lot of time to completely reconfigure a kit in the 15 minutes you have between set times. So a lot of times I'll be like, hey, you know, other drummer, you set it up for you and I'll just deal with it. You know, and it just, it improves your playing. It gives you a little challenge, and, you know, cause you just never know when there's going to be times when, you know, I, as an open-handed drummer, I'm going to have to play right-handed. You know, there's only one ride, for instance, and, you know, it's going to be on the right side and I don't have time to throw it over on the left. So it's a calming situation to be able to do it. Okay, well, you got to play this show right-handed, Gene. Okay, no problem. You know, we can do that. So
that's amazing. So when you tour, do you rent a kit or do you bring the kit with you?
Most times these days, we tend to bring it with us. And like, for instance, I have like say Testament, for instance. I have my kit and all my hardware in the U.S., and I have an exact duplicate of everything over in Europe. So, you know, we've got the European rig and the U.S. rig, and so you don't have to cart your drums over. However, when Testament did the Soundwave Festival in Australia a few years back, maybe that was 2014, we sent our gear on a literal slow boat to Australia. You know, it took 2 months for the gear to get there, just inside one of those giant boat, you know, rectangle storage things. And it took 2 months to get back and ruined my gear pretty much. You know, all the humidity, they tried to pack it with a bunch of silica, but you know, my snare, for instance, my beautiful, awesome, wonderful, amazing snare that had just got refurbished to make it look and sound so beautiful, that thing came back looking like it just was buried in a swamp for 2 months. You know, it just oxidized and the tone changed on it. I was like, oh man, boo. But you know, for the most part, we tend, like in Australia for the Dark Angel, upcoming Dark Angel stuff, I usually just speak with I have my companies that endorse me. They're on it. You know, my tech, Jeff, he's the manager of the Atomic Clock drum department. You know, he takes care of all that stuff. I'm pretty lazy. I don't have to reach out and speak to a lot of people individually about, hey, I need this kind of kit. You know, my tech, Jeff, takes care of that. And usually we get what they want. You know, we get what we want. They know how to provide it. And, you know, even for with these shows, for instance, these Australian shows coming up, they're all fly dates for the band, but a lot of times they'll send the gear overnight in a truck. With the crew, you know, and I do understand that driving in Australia at night is quite the hazardous experience. Oh, you know, there's kind of like, there's some windows that you need to be cognizant of, you know, because like driving at, you know, at 2 a.m. sort of thing is no bueno when you're out there. You know, you don't want to be doing that because, you know, kangaroos will be jumping, launching themselves at your truck sort of thing.
Yeah. So. Well, not only that, but Australia doesn't really have the population to where the taxes pay for this big lane, you know, multi-lane road. So quite often you're on a two-lane road and you're just zooming past people. So there's a lot of, you got to watch out not to fall asleep. Because it's
I do remember
you won't just
that.
Drive totally. Into the weeds. You could screw a lot of things up. Hey,
absolutely.
So Gene, I'll make you the offer, and I don't make this to anyone. If you want to store a drum set at my house, you're more than welcome to.
Excellent.
Exactly.
Good to know it.
It'll be set up, and I'll make sure the cats don't get around it or anything. And I could even help wake up the neighbors occasionally. So that's just
between
you and I. Just let me know.
Duly noted. Thank you, Nick. That's awesome.
So what got you into music when you were young? What was it that kind of, you know, perked up the ears and made the Gene Hoglund antenna stick up straight?
Well, I guess, you know, I when I was living in El Paso, Texas, I was two. I was born in Dallas, and then my family moved to El Paso. And, you know, Texas was, they've always been known to have a really great, you know, radio. Mm-hmm. You know, Texas radio was always great. And, you know, my parents always liked telling the story about when I was two, I heard a Santana song on the radio called No One to Depend On. And I demanded that my folks, you know, take me to the record store, pick me up that single. That was the first single I ever got. I remember it was backed with a song called Taboo, but I still have that 45. But, you know, this was 50 years ago. Jesus. But I was just super into music. And you know how a lot of times when you're growing up, your parents just have an atrocious sense of music. You know, what they listen to is nowhere near what you would be into. I was fortunate that my folks had a pretty decent record collection and a pretty decent, you know, taste in music. My dad was super into you know, like soul music. So, you know, I grew up with a lot of the Motown and a lot of the Broadway, like Jesus Christ Superstar. And I was going to a lot of Broadway shows with my folks when I was a kid, you know, and they weren't like trying to culturally escalate my vision or anything. It was just, that's the kind of music they were into. And I was like, hey, this is cool. I don't hate this. And so even when I started getting into rock and roll super big time, you know, like I was just glued to the radio, you know, the AM pop radio of 1969 through 76 or so. And the 76 is when I started super getting into rock and roll. And I was about 7 or 8 at the time. So, you know, my folks were pretty supportive of that. My sister was 5 years older than me. So granted, you know, she'd be bringing home the latest records and I'd be sneaking into her room to listen to them and stealing them and that sort of thing. So, you know, I was always surrounded by music and, you know, I guess what would become known as, you know, the American classic rock, you know, I grew up on that, you know, all the Aerosmith and Cheap Trick and, you know, some of the European Queen, obviously Black Sabbath, Angel, Kiss, all those, you know, those are all my staples. So.
Do you remember the record or records that you got that were truly yours? Like the ones that your family didn't quite get involved, the ones you found sideways through friends or another way?
Yeah, absolutely. My first two albums that I owned and I discovered them on my own were, the first one was Endless Summer from the Beach Boys. And the second one was Spirit of America by the Beach Boys. And both of those are compilation records, but you know, I was 7 and I was just a huge Beach Boys fan. And those are my first two records. And the first record that I bought for myself was Kiss's Destroyer. And that was in 76, about the year it came out. So that's when I discovered those guys. And, you know, I came along late to the Kiss game. I was 8. You know,
so. Yeah, well, Destroyers, I think that's about where a lot of people kind of got to them. I mean, not too many people.
I think so.
I think they were more East Coast for Dressed to Kill. I think then Alive kind of burst them open. And then, yeah, that's the way I have it in my head.
Totally.
Let me ask you this. Do you remember when Kiss Meets the Phantom of the Park came on TV?
I remember when it was filmed, man. I was so bummed. It was filmed up at Magic Mountain in 1978, May of 78. And I had a baseball game that night, so I couldn't go to the show, you know. So I was super into baseball as well. And it was like my team was fighting for the playoffs at the time. And so I was like, oh, man, God, I want to go to the show, and I can't. But, yeah, I remember that well, you know. I watched it when it came out, and I thought it was genius, you know. Like when I was 10 or whatever, 11 when it came out, I thought that was just an absolute work of art. But
have you watched it
but
since?
There you go. Yes, like Chuck from Death was the biggest Kiss fan, and we watched it, and oh man, we were just, you know, watching it through your palm, you know, kind of thing. Like, oh man, this is great. Yeah, awesome.
So when did you decide to go from listener to participant?
Well, that was actually very early on as well. You know, like when I was like, I've told many, many people over the years that I am the absolute poster child for living your dream. I am living the dream that I set out to live when I was, you know, started when I was about 11 or so. And by 13, it was just cemented that, yes, this is what you want to do. You want to be a rock and roll drummer, play in a rock and roll band, tour the world, see the world, you know, pay your bills through it. And, you know, I knew early on, you know, I there was the crossroads when I was younger where it's like, hey, Gene, you know, you could have a pretty good baseball career in front of yourself. You know, like a lot of the guys that I used to own in Little League, you know, I used to dominate over, those guys became pros, you know, and, you know, one of them's in the Hall of Fame now. So, or I think, you know, possibly he was an all-star for many years, a guy named JT Snow. And God, I used to own that kid back in the day, but, you know, stuff like that. And I was always larger than the other kids. So, you know, I had a pretty dominating, I was a dominating pitcher. And, you know, my dad was always trying to kind of, squeeze me into that sort of life. And he was always, you know, I was like, nope, I'm going to be a rock and roller, Dad. I'm going to play heavy metal for a living. He's like, oh God, Jesus. Why don't you try the baseball first and then like make a bunch of millions of dollars and then retire at age 30, you know? And then start your musical career. I was like, oh man, I'm not feeling baseball. You know, baseball would make me cut my hair. I wasn't about to do that. There were no Dennis Rodmans at the time where, you know, the freaks were allowed and accepted. No, it's like, if you looked different, if you had long hair and you dressed like a fucking freakazoid the way I did, you were a pariah, you know, and I would dominate all these other kids in my leagues, yet I would not make the all-star team because I did not represent the league. It's like, dudes, I'm batting 750 and I've got 6 no hitters. Like, you don't want this on your team because I have long hair and I wear my sister's clothes? Like, really? But that's stuff like that would happen. So it was like baseball was very exclusionary and rock and roll was inclusionary. You know, it was all about, you know, like, hey, you get to fly your freak flag. And so that's, you know, when I was about 11, that's when I started going, yeah, this is what I wanted to do. And then since my sister is 5 years older and I was 13, but I did not look 13. I had a little mustache and little goatee started. And, you know, I wore dark glasses all the time and I was 6'3" sort of thing.
This is no longer in Texas. You're now in California. Is that right?
I'm in California. Okay. Yeah. By then. Yeah, okay. Totally. And going out to all the LA clubs and seeing all the LA bands before they became those big radio, huge bands, you know, seeing all the Motley Crues and Rats and Great Whites and all of those bands in the clubs and becoming friends with those guys. You know, my sister was older and, you know, she was, you know, befriending a lot of these bands and being kind of the mom to the homeless, you know, mm-hmm. musician that couldn't make it back to his place.
The den mother. Yeah.
Yeah. Kind of, you know, drag him home, put him on the couch, feed him some soup. And I'd wake up in the mornings. There'd be a member of Great White or Dawkins or somebody on my couch because I couldn't, you know, Lisa was their little den mom for the night sort of thing. So I grew up having an adolescence that was unlike everybody else's. You know, I was just looking around at all my high school, you know, all the high school people that I was going to school with. And I just had so much disdain for them because they just led these really safe little plastic lives where they liked their Duran Duran and their, you know, all that radio new wave garbage. You know, that was not me. You know,
this morning, Tommy Lee was throwing up in my toilet. He had nothing in common with these kids.
Totally. Yeah, totally. You know?
So when did you decide drums would be the instrument for you?
When I was about 8, I became an absolute master of the air drum. Mm-hmm. And air drumming, that's seriously how I got my start. You know, playing along with my records, just miming. I had a little pair of sticks. And, you know, I taught myself how to play. You know, I was super into Kiss, obviously. And then I got into Rush pretty soon around that era too. And so, you know, Peter Criss was my first big influence. And then, you know, it's like, I was listening to Rush songs. And I was like, I can tell what he's playing. I'm air drumming along with it. And I got my kicks together with what he's doing. My hands are doing what he's doing. And yes, it is in air, but you know, by the time I sat on my first kit when I was like, oh, maybe 12 or something, I already had an aptitude for it. You know, I jammed with my cousin. I went back to Texas for a summer and my cousin was in a band. He was 6 years older than me. So, you know, I was jamming with some 18, 19 year olds and, you know, like, you know, hanging in there with them and stuff, playing all the what is now classic rock. But that was super fun. So I just kind of had an aptitude from pretty early on. And I'm a huge proponent of air drumming, you know. Even like I talk to a lot of people that are roughly my age and they're like, man, I always wanted to play drums and I always want to buy a drum set, but you know, I just don't have room for it. And I'm just like, dude, screw that. You can, oh man, I just got stung by a bee. Jesus.
You did?
I have not been stung by a bee.
You're not allergic, are you?
No, we're about to find out.
All right. I'll have 911 on speed dial here for you if you want.
Yeah, man, Jesus. I've been stung. Last time I got stung was in, I was 7. So, and I didn't have any adverse reactions, but how do I pull this motherfucker out? Jesus. I just all of a sudden felt, I'm just out here on my back porch, and I felt something crawling on my foot, and sometimes it's a fly or something, and I just swiped it. Now I swiped the bee off. He's on the ground, but now I got this pulsating thing in my toe. That's my drumming toe, you fucker.
Oh, man.
Yeah, this is crazy.
I hope the tour's still on.
This is awesome. Yeah, shit, man. Boy, we'll find out if I'm allergic. I'm going to have to figure this out in a minute. I'm going to get some tweezers out because it's got this little pulser just pulsing stuff into my leg right now.
You know, you've actually taken over for drummers who've been sick or who couldn't make a gig. I think Charlie from Anthrax, you jumped in for one time.
That's right.
How little advance notice do you need in order to do that?
Well, let's see. Sometimes it's as little as that afternoon sort of thing. I remember there was a tour here in the States. It was a big festival tour called the Sounds of the Underground. And I was out with Strapping, and some of the headliners of that tour were Lamb of God, Opeth, Gwar, a bunch of other people. And I loved Opeth. And so I would go out and catch their show every night. And I was kind of watching their drummer, Martin, kind of, struggle to get through these shows. I'm just like, oh man, boo. And so I came into catering one day. This was in Tulsa, Oklahoma. And I see all the guys from Opeth looking pretty glum. And I walk over to their table. Hey, what's going on, guys? And they're like, oh man, we had to send Martin home, and now we're out here right now and we don't have a drummer. And we go on and 4 hours or something. And they turned to me and they said, hey, do you think you could pull off our set? I was like, fuck, let's try it. Let's do it. So, I had my little Walkman and they provided me with the set list and a couple of discs to learn. And so, yeah, by that evening, they were, their slot that night was a little bit earlier than they normally go on. So we did have to play at, 5 o'clock in the afternoon sort of thing, 6 o'clock, something like that. Mm-hmm. Ow, this thing's really starting to hurt. Jesus. I haven't done anything to it, but...
Is it swelling?
I can't tell if that's... Well, yeah, sort of. Oh, yeah, my...
Need to get some ice?
Hang on one second. I just want to see if this is blood or this is a sticker. Man.
You know I'm going to leave this whole thing in the interview, right?
God, yeah, might as well, man. Fucking hell. That's crazy. Okay, well, that's... Thank God I got its sticker out. Okay, I think that's a sticker. Now it's just bleeding, but man, this just feels like a pinprick, but it just won't stop.
Yeah, it's annoying. It's painful, but annoying. Yeah,
yeah, and hopefully not deadly. Hopefully I haven't developed it. Like I say, it's been...
If your speech starts 40, slurring, I'll take action.
Yeah, it's been 45 years since I've been stung, so hey, we'll see. But yeah, so we were, we jumped on stage and I played, and I had to finish off the tour with them and there was 20 something shows and I learned their set in about 3 or 4 hours. So that was pretty good. And I remember I did some touring with Unearth and I remember I was traveling up to Vancouver where I was living. I was traveling up from LA and I got a phone call from Unearth's management saying, hey man, we just lost our drummer. Are you still in Vancouver? And I'm like, well, I'm heading up there. I'm going to be there, tonight, but I'm not there. And they said, well, we just had to let our drummer go. We have a show at the Commodore, a really well-known big Vancouver venue. And might you be able to fill in and sit in for the rest of the tour? And I was like, okie doke. And we had toured with Unearth, on two different tours. They were part of that Sounds of the Underground as well. We toured with them a couple of times and I was familiar with their, approach, but I wasn't familiar, in detail with their songs. So I had told them, look, I don't have any, I'm driving right now. It's going to take me another 10 hours to get there. But, and they said, hey, we'll call you back. And they call me, they ask me, hey, where are you? What's your location? I'm like, I'm just crossing the Oregon border right now. And they had said, well, we've called ahead to a Best Buy in Salem. And it's right off the freeway. We want you to stop in there, just walk in, collect those two records. You've already paid for them, told them what's going on, and just go in there, get them, and maybe, you know, learn the songs. You know, we've got about 7 songs in our set right now. They were opening for Dimmu Borgir. And, so I picked those up and listened to them for the next few hours and got home and, you know, just woodshedded on them. And we were fortunate. We had a little rehearsal in the afternoon, got the general gist of everything together, and then we played the show that night, and I hit the road with them after that. And, wow. You know, so that was pretty cool. So sometimes it doesn't take that long. And I'm not a reader. I don't make charts or anything. It's just, you know, learning through osmosis. You just burn that thing into your head 30 times and you better be able to play it. So there you go.
And how long does that last? Is that all short-term memory? Like if you had to do Opeth today, could you recall what you were doing when you replaced Martin originally?
I would be happy to review it. You know, so if I were to get a call right now saying, hey, Opeth's in town and they just lost their drummer, you got 45 minutes to get down there, I would just woodshed as much as I could. And, you know, a band like Opeth, I listen to them still, you know, they're one of my favorite bands. So something like that would be easier than, say, an Unearth. You know, I really enjoy Unearth's music, too. However, you know, I haven't. You know, I go back and listen to some Unearth every once in a while, but it's not as deeply
ingrained, I guess, is what you're saying, yeah.
Indeed, but I could still pull it off.
I'm sure you
could. I'll figure it out.
Are there bands out there where you're kind of looking at them and going like, boy, I hope that drummer catches a cold. I'd love to play that set.
Oh, absolutely, Stevie Wonder, man, let's kill off your drummer anytime. You know, I'd play for Stevie in a minute.
Outside of metal, like, what do you enjoy listening to?
Gosh, everything. Like, I'm such an old soul fan. I love Motown. I love, you know, God, I'm watching this great documentary that just came on cable about, you know, the creation of Motown. That's really awesome. And, you know, I love all the American classic rock. I love, you know, I was on your site, you know, earlier, and I was checking it out, and I see you did some stuff with Roger Manning. You know, I'm a huge Jellyfish fan. Oh. I love Jellyfish. Those guys are great. You know, I'm a huge Roger Manning fan. That's really awesome. So that's cool. And I saw you did some stuff with Trey from Mr. Bungle. I love Mr. Bungle.
Yeah.
You know, love their first record. That was awesome. You know, I try to have a very open mind about the only kind of music I can't really stand is like this. If it's just, it doesn't matter what era it is, whether it's from the 80s, 90s, or present, the plastic pop, you know, top 10 kind of thing where it just sounds, there's no creativity in that. For me, there's just the formula to make the money, to, you know, to just make money. If something is coming from the heart, I understand that. Like, for instance, I might not be into this guy's music, like say somebody like Ed Sheeran, you know, I don't know his music that much, but a few years ago I saw him do this tribute to Stevie Wonder where he just starts, you know, he plays a lick and he taps a button and that starts to loop. Then he plays another lick, taps a button, that starts to loop. And I think he did like Living for the City or something. It was something really cool. And it's like, wow, hey, I might not be into this guy's music, but I could tell he has talent. And I would imagine his music is probably coming from the heart more so than like, say, a Taylor Swift or Ariana Grande or Justin Bieber. Like, that is not my scene at all, because there isn't any creativity there. There's no passion. There's no like somebody just like, oh, I'm bleeding this song. No, it's like you got handed a song by your management and hey, you know, let's make some money, kid.
Yeah.
You know, that's not my scene.
Well, when I hear Ed Sheeran, like especially with those loop pedals, I'm fascinated by that. And to me, I don't know how much of the audience kind of gets that, because I know I've spent a lot of time behind mixing boards and things, so I know how much of a tightrope he's walking when he's doing all those combined loops.
I know the thing's on YouTube. I know that thing I saw was on YouTube again. So I went back and watched it. I was like, yeah, God, that's really cool. So I forget the song. It's a Stevie Wonder song. It might have been a tribute to Stevie that night. And you know, like the whole TV show that I watched was a tribute to Stevie, and everybody that knows me knows how much I love Stevie Wonder, so I will catch anything Stevie related. So there you go.
So what is your criteria for selecting projects?
Well, I tell you, it's it is helpful to like the music. I guess that's my interest level gets when the music is really cool, my interest level gets beyond the okay, here's a session. Mm-hmm. You know, because I do lots of sessions where it's like, okay, music's whatever, but hey, they're paying you to do this, so get in there and do a cool job. You know, it's always really cool when something comes along where you're like, wow, this music is really, really good. For instance, this just is in the process of getting released as we speak. It's the Brian Beller solo record, and Brian I play with in Death Clock, and you know, he hit me up to play on a couple of his songs, and those songs were great. They were amazing, most challenging, engaging songs I've recorded in a while, you know, so that was really cool. And so I guess that's my criteria. Just like, the music's got to be good, you know. And I've been on some pop projects that were completely, you know, 180 degree from the super metal that I play, but the projects were really good. You know, the music was good. The songwriting was well done. So, and it seemed like there was passion and creativity behind it. It wasn't, you know, oh, I'm just doing this to make some money. No. So, oh man, these guys, now I'm getting attacked by ants. What the hell?
Oh my God.
I'm critter fodder out here.
What have you done to the insect community?
Yeah, man, boy.
They've declared war on Gene Hoagland. Do you do unnamed sessions, like going in there, signing an NDA and playing drums and not telling a soul?
They're not too often, but there have been some things where, you know, hey, you can't announce this yet. We'll let you know when you can, and they'll sit on the project for a year. Like for instance, we in the latest Godzilla movie, I played drums on we did a cover. It was myself, Brian Beller, and Brendan Small, the creator and lead dude from Death Clock. We played all the instrumentation, and there was Serge Tankian on vocals, and we did a cover of BOC's Godzilla for the Godzilla movie. And it was this whacked out cover, you know, it's a totally different take on the song. It had like Japanese taiko drummers on it with their chanting and all that sort of stuff. And it was pretty interesting. And there was an example, you're doing this session at this, you know, at Capitol Records for a major movie blockbuster release. And they just said, hey, you know, please don't say anything. We'll let you know when you can. And sure enough, you know, 2-3 weeks before the movie got released, that's when they released the single and announced it. And that's when so, you know, people were all, and you know, I teased it on my Instagram, like, hey, something really cool. And I'm filming the studio and hey, something really cool went down here today. And naturally everybody's like, are you finally recording the new Dark Angel record? Yes. And no, but it's still pretty cool. And we'll let you know in a year.
What's the best rumor you've ever heard about yourself?
This isn't so much a rumor, but God, back in the day in LA, there was a guy that used to impersonate me and go to clubs and get in free and get free drinks and that sort of thing, you know, and people would tell me about it. And, you know, I finally met the dude and I was like, yeah, okay, well, I can see where people would think you're me. But as for rumors, you know, there was a rumor of my death, you know, back when I was in strapping, and, you know, people panicked about that. And contrary to popular belief, you know, I'm still around.
Right.
But yeah, I don't get the rumor mill that much. I'm not as sociable as I used to be. Like, you know, when it comes to like the social media and things like that, I'm a little on the outside of it. So, hell, there could be some raging rumors about me that I'd never see, you know, because I'm not on Facebook on a daily basis going, oh, what are people saying about me? I got enough things to say about myself. I don't need other people's opinions on me. So
you've never heard the rumors of, oh, Gene has this leg implant that helps him drum for hours more than an average drum. Nothing like that.
I probably put that one out. I probably put that rumor out on myself.
You had an extra rib inserted.
Well, I mean, there are things out there that are actually true. that people think are rumors. Like, for instance, I will play with leg weights on, you know, 5-pound weights on each leg. And sometimes people will see me like walking to the stage or something, if we're playing a big festival or something, and they're like, holy crap, you actually do use leg weights. You know, like, I thought people were joking, you know, like, no.
Or it's one of those tracking devices.
When I play.
So the leg weights, that is fascinating, because does it help your foot stay steady? Is that kind of the reason why?
Well, what it does is, like, it's all kind of whichever band I'm playing with that night, it's kind of dependent on the band. Say a Death Clock or Death to All, you know, or even Dark Angel, you know, something where there's a lot of Savage double bass all over the set. I'll warm up with the leg weights. A lot of times I'll pop them off. If not, before the set starts, I'll pop them off pretty early. Say when it comes to a band like Testament, where there's not a lot of double bass. I mean, there is, but it's not a relentless onslaught of double bass in a Testament set. Mm-hmm. I'll keep the leg weights on until the Savage double bass song comes along 8 or 9 songs into the set, and I'll pop them off before that. And sometimes I'll just be a jerk and just keep them on for the whole show. But the reason I wear them is when you do take the leg weights off, your feet fly. Like, you've just got this extra oomph little pile of speed that is in reserves, and you pop the leg weights off and then you're totally cooking and everything's really smooth. And one thing about playing drums while you have leg weights on is it starts establishing muscles in your leg that you don't normally have, you know, 'cause, you know, doing the up and down or whatever a leg does while it's drumming. That's one thing. But then when you tack on 5 pounds with this, that'll add, you know, just extra musculature to yourself. And therefore there is more power and more control going on for what you're doing. And I used to play in, you know, big Doc Martin boots, you know, and I had these same pair of boots that I played in for like a dozen years until those boots finally fell apart, and I'd wear the leg weights with the boots, and people were just like, dude, really? You know, like, leg weights and big boots? Like, dude, come on.
I would, you know, think so. That with boots, you would have to get the exact same kind of boot because you're so familiar with the weighting and the distribution. Is that the case?
Well, that was the thing. And these boots that I had, they discontinued them pretty quickly after, you know, after I had these boots for a couple of years and they were starting to get a little beat up. I went back to the same place where they had them, and that boot has been discontinued, my man. So I was like, oh shit. Well, so much for that. So I just kept playing with them until they, you know, literally fell apart. I mean, they're in pieces in my closet right now. And you know, it's like, God, they're big giant holes, you know, where the sole was separating from the leather part of the boot. So
Gene,
if
those
you're playing
should be
a big
in a museum.
Festivals,
those should be in a museum somewhere, quite honestly.
I think at some point, hey, you never know. So, but yeah, you know, just they just fell apart. And now I'm back. The only reason I ever played in boots is that's what I wore. And, you know, I tried going back to some other boots, and my wife bought me some kick-ass boots, but I tend to kick my shoes off a lot during the day. And my old style of boots, they were just so just beat up. They turned into slip-on boots, you know? I mean, I didn't tie the laces in years. And so I could just slip them on, slip them off. And the newer pair of boots I got, they needed a zipper or something along the side, so I could just quickly get them off, because these were lace ups. You got to lace them all the way up, and then to take them off, got to lace them off. And oh man, it's a pain in the ass. So now I'm just playing in just some tennis shoes, you know, back to the old school thrash metal days of that. So there you go.
I want to give you a plug here for the Atomic Clock DVD, because people go to HoaglandIndustries.com. There's this DVD, this video, and there's actually two now. There's a couple of them, right?
That's right.
Of Gene playing. And I got to tell you, it is such it's multi-camera. So one camera's on the feet, one camera's on the hands. There's an overhead. There's a few cameras going on. And watching Gene play, especially the boots going back and forth. And these are the boots you're talking about are the flame boots, right? The flame.
That's right.
Yeah. And I can see they're unlaced and everything. And they're falling apart in the new one. But just watching your feet go, it is, again, just like an atomic clock. And the look on your face, you seem very casual with it. Like going back to where you had to urgently play that second set with Opeth, and then you were also on tour with your other band. Was it difficult for you to play multiple shows a day? It seems like it's quite effortless for you.
Oh, no, God, I love it. I love playing. Give me three shows a day. I love it. You know, that's like, for instance, when I started playing with Anthrax, you know, that was a situation similar to the Opeth thing. Charlie came to me on the first day of the tour and said, you know, I've got some serious, you know, issues going on at home. I need to leave the tour. ASAP, could you take over? And I was like, yeah, sure. He's like, well, I gotta, you know, it was like, say, a Monday. And by Thursday, I was playing with Anthrax, you know. Mm-hmm. So I had a couple of days to learn the set. I just sat behind Charlie and filmed his set, and I played the set the way that he did, like all the brand new things, like a lot of the arrangements to Anthrax material has, you know, they've evolved over the years, and Charlie does not do the same things he did on recording. It would have been one thing to just say, okay, I'm just gonna, you know, put a playlist together of all your songs and I'll just learn the albums and yeah, we can make this happen. That would probably throw the rest of the guys on stage off. You know, it's like, hey, wait a minute. I haven't even listened to this record in 20 years. And now you're playing the version that's on the record. Oh, fuck, I can't remember this. So I learned all of Charlie's present licks and I loved it. You know, a lot of people were asking me, like, you know, Testament was playing 70 minutes and then Anthrax was playing for 90. So there's 2 hours and 40 minutes of drumming every night. And, you know, people were looking at me like I was, you know, like I was this maniac. And I'm just like, dude, this is easy. You know, like playing 2.5 hours a night. Like when we record albums, I'm playing for 10 hours a day. If you're rehearsing for an album or something, you're rehearsing for 6-8 hours a day. So playing for 2.5 hours, this ain't nothing. You know, there's nothing special in this. This is, mm-hmm. you know, this is what I do. I play drums. So, but I love doing double, triple sets. Like that was one thing that was super fun for me on that. We did Slayer's first two legs of their farewell tour in 2018, Testament did. And I knew going into the tour that I was going to be doing some shows with Anthrax, because that's just, Charlie has it kind of built into his touring system that he's got to be at home for a certain amount of time. And so I knew that was going to happen. I was like, yes, that gives me something to do, you know, because Testament was opening the show at 5 p.m. By 5:35, our day is done. Our bus call is usually around 2 a.m. every night. So I'm like, oh, God, I've got like 8 hours or something to do nothing. But hey, at least I got some of these shows. I'm going to be playing with Anthrax. That's going to be cool. And then about halfway through the first leg, I took over directing Slayer's video screens. When we would be playing venues, like a lot of the amphitheaters that have the big screens on the side of the stage showing the players on stage what they're doing, you know, we'd go out every night and catch Slayer's set from front of house. And their show was so mind-boggling, so amazing. The pyro was just so, you know, literally on fire. However, Slayer was not, they did not bring their own video package crew. They were just using all the local guys in the local places that we were playing, just the local in-house guys. And a lot of these guys were like, you know, 65-year-old country music fans. They didn't get the music. They didn't understand it. So we're out in front of house watching this amazing show. And a lot of these places are these big sheds out in the States, you know, the big lawn area in the back, where for those people watching the band are ants on stage. You rely on the screens. And I'm just thinking, man, all these people back here are getting ripped off. This is their last final time to be able to see Slayer. And you know, it was well documented. They're, you know, on the screens, you know, Gary is peeling off some kick-ass lead and they're filming Tom staring at Paul. And, you know, it's just like, oh, come on, you know, all these people back here are just getting robbed. So I went to Slayer's people and I just said, hey, let me do this. Let me take over. You know, I have no idea what I'm doing, but I don't care. I'll figure it out. You know, I can do a better job. I can put the camera on the right guy who's playing the lead at the time. I can do that, you know? Yeah. And they were like, oh shit, really? You do that? And I was like, yeah. So after, you know, I remember the first show was just me sitting next to the director. Just, I had a, you know, a little pencil in my hand and I'd point at the, you know, you got a bank of video screens. I'd point at the video screen with, you know, here's Gary's lead. Okay, there's the screen with Carrie. There's his lead. And, you know, back to the vocals. And I just started paying attention to how that local director was running the thing. I'm like, okay, well, next show, I did the same thing, just pointed out to the director, but I was paying attention. And so after about three or four shows, I started putting the headphones on and directing, you know, like, okay, camera one, get on your vocalist, camera two, get on your bald guy. And, you know, that kind of thing. And I started putting together a little show, you know, like it was, you know, the screens were choreographed as mm-hmm. well, you know, like Slayer's got all their marks that they're hitting. And I'm hitting marks too with the cameras and the angles, and I'm setting up shots, and, you know, I had no idea what I'm doing, but I did it.
You're like the Steven Spielberg of Slayer there, yeah?
Yeah, totally, man. It was great. And that also gave me something to do. There would be times when I'd play with Testament, then go play with Anthrax, and then do Slayer screens at night. And I was like, those were my favorite gigs. It's like I had something to do all day long. I wasn't just sitting around in catering, eating, you know, eating pulled pork sandwiches for 4 hours, you know, like it gave me something to do and I was super into it. So there's a show coming up in a couple of weeks here in the States, a Chicago show called the Riot Fest. It's a big festival that happens every year and Slayer and Testament are playing. So I'd imagine I'm probably going to do Slayer screens that night too. So that's super fun. Mm-hmm. And that's something that kind of comes around full circle because Slayer's very, very first tour was my very first tour. I went on tour with Slayer when I was 16. I was their light guy. Mm-hmm. And I would also sit in for Dave during sound checks, and I'd play some of their sound checks with them just so Dave could go out in the front of house and hear what the band sounds like. The drummer never gets to do that. You know, you never have a guy that just happens to be here that can play your band's material so you can go out and hear what it sounds like. You know, if you're a guitarist, you got your wire loose, you can step out front and hear it. Vocalists do the same, but drummers, you're rooted on stage. You never get to hear what your band sounds like out front. So, you know, that sort of thing, that's what I was doing. And that was 1984. So, it kind of came around full circle, you know, and here I am on their last tour, working for them again.
You're absolutely right. That is a total full circle. You started off with Slayer, and now you're seeing them on their final shows. Look, Gene, it's been great talking with you. I'd love to have you back on the show because there's so much more we could talk about. Fear Factory, your time with Strapping, working with Devin, some of the other records of your career, some of the early pressings on Combat I'd love to talk with you about, but I'll have to forego that to make sure everyone knows about these things. First, the Atomic Clock DVD. Go to HoaglandIndustries.com. Check out this video of Gene playing the drums. It is fascinating. Even for non-drummers, just to watch an artist doing what he does, it is just incredible. It's mesmerizing. So that's HoaglandIndustries.com, the Atomic Clock DVD, part one and two. And of course, if you're in Australia, make sure you catch Dark Angel on their September tour. September 25th, The Zoo in Brisbane. September 26th, Manning Bar in Sydney. September 27th, Max Watts in Melbourne. And September 28th, Enigma in Adelaide. I'll be at the Sydney show. So listeners, direct message me and we'll slam a beer together. Gene, thank you so much for coming on The Vinyl Guide, mate.
Oh, Nate, thank you so much. This was great, man, and definitely I'd love to have another chat anytime, man. And, you know, if I could add one last thing to those Dark Angel shows, please. I'm also doing clinics directly after the tour. I'm not sure which cities they're going to be in, but just everybody, you know, pay attention to the socials and keep your eye open, and I'm going to be doing a couple of drum clinics there in Australia. And those are really, really fun too. I try to make those super entertaining. It's really just like a comedy routine with some drumming going on. So I try to make those for if you're not a drummer, it's cool. If you're not a musician, it's cool. You know, it's hopefully it's a couple hours well spent. Hopefully people enjoy it. And I'd like to just add those little tidbits of information in there at the end of this one. So
far
appreciate
out.
It.
I'll see if I could get those that information and put it on this episode page.
Fantastic.
All right, there he is, Gene Hoagland, the Atomic Clock. And I'm telling you, Australia, you got to see Dark Angel. Head over to hardlinemedia.net. Grab your tickets now. Everywhere else in the world, you could go to hoaglandindustries.com and check out the Atomic Clock videos up there. Order one of the DVDs. He's an amazing drummer. I'm going to put a link to one of his videos in this episode page. You got to see him in action. It's friggin' amazing. He's ambidextrous. He's doing it left. He's doing it right. He switches within moments. Not even moments. He just switches automatically. Gene Hoagland is a true music icon, so make sure you see him when you can. And that's it for this week's episode of The Vinyl Guide. Thanks again for tuning in. Please share this with your friends. Put it on Facebook and Twitter and Instagram and all those other places. If you've got friends that are vinyl record nuts and enjoy music and you think they'll like what we do here at The Vinyl Guide, show them how to use their smartphone to subscribe to the podcast. Lots of times, that's all it takes. A friend to walk you through how to subscribe to a podcast. Then they'll be hooked. Then you'll have something to talk about. Thanks again for all that. Thanks again for being awesome listeners. Until we talk next time, keep spinning. Cheers.
That's it for this episode of The Vinyl Guide. Send your thoughts to Nate at thevinylguide.com or follow or tag us on Instagram at Vinyl Guide. Until next time, keep spinning.